Guys and Dolls is a 1950 musical with music and lyrics by Frank Loesser and a book by Joe Swerling and Abe Burrows. It's based on the short stories of Damon Runyon. In the show, Nathan Detroit, the broke host of an illegal gambling ring, is hoping to win $1,000 so he can continue to host his game. He makes what is supposed to be an impossible bet with the gambler he knows, Sky Masterson, that Sky can't take out the pious Sarah Brown to dinner in Cuba. Meanwhile, Nathan's longtime fiance, Adelaide, is growing increasingly frustrated that he refuses to marry her. Hijinks ensue as the two men try to woo their dates, win their bets, and avoid the cops trying to shut down their gambling. My guest today is Philip Michaels, who hosts Magnum Podcast and Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies on The Incomparable. I hope you enjoy our conversation about Guys and Dolls. Hello, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. I am so excited to dive into Guys and Dolls.
Well, it's a good one.
Well, let's start with, how did you first hear this musical?
Sure. I first heard this musical because I was cast in this musical. It was the musical production at my high school, my junior year in high school. And the way we did it is that every other year we did a musical. My freshman year, it was Grease. I can't stand Grease, so I didn't even bother trying out for that. My junior year was Guys and Dolls, and I was cast in it. So even if I hadn't seen it before, I certainly had seen it then. I took a liking to it. And the fact that it was also revived in the 1990s made it something that I was conscious of then too.
My favorite thing is when people talk about musicals that they were in as like either children or in high school.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing.
Yes.
So what role did you play?
I played Lieutenant Brannigan, the non-singing, non-dancing role. Thank you very much. And even worse than that, for reasons that I still wake up thinking about now 30 years later, instead of Lieutenant Brannigan, who would be a plainclothes policeman, the director of this production decided to put me in a policeman's outfit and have me carrying around a nightclub as if a lieutenant in the New York City police force is still walking a beat like a chump. So no, I was slightly embittered by that, as you might could tell from my voice. But in addition, because, you know, there's only so many fellas in a high school musical cast, I was also singer dancer on both the Luck Be a Lady numbers. Suddenly Lieutenant Brannigan's undercover singing with the gangsters. that seems odd. And background singer dancer in the Havana scene. And I really enjoyed the fight choreography, because we staged a little fist fight that they have when Miss Sarah is getting in too much in her cups. And me and my friend worked out this wonderful little routine where we danced like Muppets and then started hitting each other. And I had a fake mustache that kept flying off. And that is my Guys and Dolls story.
So you were demoted and deep undercover twice.
Yes.
In two different settings.
Exactly. Lieutenant Brannigan followed Sky Masterson all the way to Cuba to get intel. And then got too much into the role. So finally, he gets to go into the sewer and dance and sing. And he just enjoyed dancing and singing. And then has to change back into his policeman's clothes to run back in for Sit Down, You're Rockin' the Boat.
That's like a whole secret art going on in the background.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really excited to dive so far into Guys and Dolls, because I think this is actually one of my favorite sort of classic golden age musicals. And I never really thought about it that much until I studied it as part of a class on musicals and plays, but I didn't care about those as much, of the 40s and 50s. And so we had a whole week where we just talked about Guys and Dolls, and I was like, I actually really like this. This is a very interesting show.
Yeah, I like the source material, the Damon Runyon stories, and the started life out as a sports writer, which is the other interest of my life. And so I've read his sport accounts, which you will be shocked to know or have a lot of the same patois that finds its way into this musical.
One note I thought was funny is when I was reading about this, a lot of the reviews mentioned that the Guys and Dolls musical was really faithful to the source material in terms of like capturing Runyon's spirit and the way that he wrote and everything. And I was like, That's nice. I had no idea. Because, I mean, I read that, you know, they're based on the stories of Damon Runyon. And I'm mm-hmm. like, that sounds fine. Great. Lots of musicals are based on source material. Makes sense. I had no idea that he was so popular as a writer that, like, the reviewers would be referencing how faithful they were to the source stories.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it is a very distinct pattern of speech, as you can gather from watching the musical. This, it's very much the leave us go and do the thing. And so if they were suddenly not speaking like the people in Runyon's stories, it would have been very noticeable. So I think that is actually one of the... one of the charming bits about the musical, that they're able to recapture that, and that Frank Lesser was able to write songs in that pattern too, with Call a Lawyer and Sue Me and all that. That is that Damon Runyon could have written that song, in essence.
And the songs in this musical are just so fun. It's also interesting because I read that they had a book that was sort of written with Lesser's music, and then they said, it's bad. This is not, we can't use this. And so they hired a new writer, A. Burroughs, to write a new book, but they still liked all the songs. So Burroughs basically had to tailor his script to go with all of the songs that Lesser had already written, which, I mean, worked out really well in the end. Like, it all fits together. But there are still moments where things like, for example, Sit Down, You're Rocking the Boat, which is just like such an iconic song and such a great performance number.
Uh-huh.
And the scenes that have to be written to get you to that point are so specific.
For the people all said, sit down, you're rocking a boat. People all said, sit down, you're rocking a boat. And the devil will drag you under by the sharp lapel of your checkered coat. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking a boat.
The sandwich around it is really strange, and
yeah.
what I actually like about a lot of stagings, I was watching just the other night the clips of the 1995 revival that they have. This was the one where Nathan Lane was Nathan Detroit and Peter Gallagher was Sky Masterson. The popular clip that they used for the Tonys was Sit Down, You're Rocking the Boat. They just do the number and boom, stop, number over, let's go back to our play. So, and a lot of the guys and dolls stagings are like that. It's, yep, well, nicely had his number, and now we're going to go back to talking about how we were shooting craps in the Mission last night.
Well, in 1950, that's what passed for a smooth transition.
Yeah, it's true. It is true. But they don't even people who bring back that show don't make any attempt to write their way out of that little plot hole.
Well, that's charming. One more thing that I thought was really interesting about the development of this is that a lot of it was developed with the actors in mind, which is always so fun to see how shows get shaped by their originating actors. Specifically, the sort of lead role of Nathan Detroit was crafted around Sam Levine, right, who is not a singer.
No.
So he's the lead role in this musical and he has one song.
Do you own the soundtrack, the original Broadway soundtrack? Or have you listened to it?
I've listened to it on Spotify.
Okay. Well, I actually bought it on physical media, but because I'm an old man. But yeah, to say that he's not a singer is, yeah, we understand. He is not. No, he does a lot of sing speaking. It's two numbers because he has Oldest Reliable, where on the original cast it's Johnny Silver and Stubby K are doing the heavy lifting on that song, and then he's got the Sue Me song, which is all him, and he is Robert Prestoning that up to a T, where he just keeping time with the music Levine, and we'll get through this somehow. And then they cast one of the greatest singers of his generation in that part for the movie, because Frank Sinatra plays Nathan Detroit in the 1955 movie, which I have some thoughts on if we want to pull back that scab right now.
I also have thoughts about this. Uh-huh. So, sure. Why don't we talk about the film adaptation, and
sure,
then maybe we'll go back and talk a little more about the show. But I do want to talk about this, so why not?
I contend the casting of Frank Sinatra as Nathan Detroit and not Sky Masterson is the worst decision that anyone ever could make in the history of casting movies. Because, again, you've got Frank Sinatra, who has this beautiful voice at the time. This was even before his voice began to go, and he had to brass it out. You cast him instead in the comic role, and another complaint I have about Frank Sinatra, not really that funny. He doesn't like... He has a thing about making himself look ridiculous, and a person who is funny has to be willing to play the fool and to look ridiculous, and that was not in Frank Sinatra's bag. So I think that was a really poor decision on their part. And it's only augmented by the fact that they cast someone who can't sing in the lead singing part with Marlon Brando, where he acts fine. The acting bits are okay, but then it's, look, be a lady to... And no, Marlon. Who told you you could do this?
It feels like they just hit shuffle on the leading men of the time, and they were like, great, Brando and Sinatra, that seems fine. You are not alone in thinking these were poor casting decisions.
No, and it's also even made worse by the fact that a lot of the Broadway cast are in the other parts. Vivian Blaine as Miss Adelaide, and you have Stubby Kaye and Johnny Silver. They even bring back Bill S. Pulley as Big Julie, and he was the original Big Julie on Broadway. So, but let's get big Hollywood Marlon Brando, who never sang before nor again, to my knowledge, and have him sing "Luck Be a Lady Tonight." They even had to write additional songs for Frank Sinatra to sing, because they have him join in on Guys and Dolls, which is normally Nicely Nicely and Benny South Street Song in the play, but in the movie Sinatra gets to sing a couple verses, and then they wrote a song specifically for the movie just so Sinatra could have something to do.
That's such typical, like, A-list actor join stage adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, give him some more songs, he has more things to do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just cast him in a different part.
Yeah, maybe cast him in the part where he has to do lots of singing. That would befit a crooner, perhaps, as he is. I mean, I don't know who they should have gotten for Nathan Detroit. We were racking our brains in our household thinking of comedic actors who could vaguely carry a tune at the time. I mean, the laziest would have been get Dean Martin, because at least he has good chemistry with Frank Sinatra. I don't think he'd have quite the shiftiness that a Nathan Detroit part requires, because there was really nothing shifty about Dean Martin. But anyone funny. As Sam Levine proved, you do not have to be able to sing to pull off that role.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, the director of the film actually wanted Levine, the original star, to take on Nathan Detroit.
Oh, and the studio said, we paid $1 million for the rights to this, and you are gonna cast Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, basically. There's also, I'm not sure about the source on this, so do take this with a grain of salt, but it's extremely plausible, is that the producer Samuel Goldwyn also didn't want a Jewish man starring in the movie. So he was like, no.
That sounds like Samuel Goldwyn, actually. So, yeah.
So lots of nastiness in all different directions in this casting choice. However, Stephen Sondheim, who was 25 years old at the time, reviewed the film and also hated this casting choice.
Yes.
And thought that Sinatra did a terrible job.
Yeah, no, this is one of, and I'm of the school of thought that actually thinks Frank Sinatra can act when he's given the right material, but this is not his part. And this is not even the greatest tragedy of Frank Sinatra in musicals. The one he really would have been good in was Carousel, and he was gonna play Billy in that. And he shows up to the set, and they're all, good news, Frank, we're filming it in two things. We're going to film it in regular with a regular camera, and then we're going to use this new Super Pan 50 technology to film the movie. And Frank Sinatra says, great, I'm getting paid twice, right? Because I only do one take. And there they say, that, no, you're not going to be. And then that was the end of him on that movie.
Oh, I am so excited to tell you this story because It's my favorite story from all of musical theater history. Apparently,
that's not why he left the movie.
Oh,
that's
really?
Why he told people he left the movie because he didn't want them to know the real reason, which is that his wife was in Africa filming a movie with Clark Gable.
Oh, this is Ava Gardner then.
Mm-hmm. And told him, if you don't get down here right now, I'm going to sleep with Clark Gable. And so he left. This was confirmed in like 2018 or something by his supposed to be co-star in Carousel. She was like,
Shirley
yeah, that
Jones.
Never added
yeah,
up.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Shirley Jones. And she was like, that story never added up. And I finally got him to admit it to me what actually happened.
Oh, that's great.
And so she revealed it like only a couple years ago.
Oh, that's great. Well, I stand corrected, and happily so.
This is my favorite fun fact.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this has been the Carousel Podcast, and.
Well, yes. Okay. Back to Guys and Dolls and the actual story of Guys and Dolls, which in itself is an absolute romp. Because we have Nathan and Skye, who are various forms of scoundrel gamblers running around. And then we have Sarah, who is our pious, just trying to save people from sin character. And then Adelaide, who is Nathan's long-suffering fiance of 14 years and a nightclub singer who just wants to marry this man who refuses to marry her.
Right. And it's the classic, she's scatterbrained but wise, and she's got the psychosomatic cold that anytime it seems like Nathan is going to string her along again, she sneezes. And the song of hers that I really like is where she's reading the book. I'm blanking on the name of the song right now.
Oh, Adelaide's Lament.
Yeah, Adelaide's Lament. Yes, the simplest name title of the entire musical. And yeah, that's really good. And Vivian Blaine really does a great job on that, both on the Broadway soundtrack and the movie. And really makes it hard for anyone who ever plays that role again to put their own stamp on it.
Yeah, I can never even think about this part without hearing her voice in my head go, person, can develop a cold.
Yep.
In other words, just from waiting around for that plain little band of gold, a person can develop a cold.
It was a popular character at the time because you also had like the Judy Holliday and the lady who was in Singing in the Rain, who plays Lena Lamont, who's again name I'm blanking on, to the point where my wife, I was watching watching the movie, and my wife walks in and goes, "Is that Lena Lamont?" Nope, but they're playing very similar characters, so I'm sure she would appreciate that.
That's fun. That all the sort of leading ladies of musical theater in that area had. Like, there were about three different parts that were just kind of copied and pasted into different musicals. But they often did have a lot to do, like, within them. And they often, like, did put on very good performances within those kind of typecasted parts. And so I appreciate a lot of them.
And Jean Hagen was the name of the actress who I momentarily forgot. That is the great Lena Lamont.
There's both a lot and very little that goes on in this show. It's a lot of running around and gambling and singing about gambling.
And yet it's nearly, apart from the Cuba scene and the sewer, it really is a one set show. You go inside the mission, you go inside Mindy's, but everything happens within like two blocks of everything. There's no elaborate set changes, and I think that's part of what makes it a popular musical to stage, because you don't have to go crazy with the sets. You have one basically Cuban flight of fancy to pull off, and you give a kid a fake mustache and you can pull that one. So
it is interesting to hear you say it all basically takes place within two blocks of each other, except for when they go to Cuba. Like, I get what you mean, but that is quite a ways away. And it is
a bit of a departure, yeah.
It is a funny contrivance in this show that they specifically go to Cuba, especially since, like, this doesn't take place in Florida. Like, it takes place in New York City. This is quite a flight.
Yes. And this, and these are 1940, 1950s aircraft we're talking about. It's not like you're there in you might have to make a stop to refuel along the way.
Well, I guess the point is it was supposed to be ridiculous, that because the bet is like, oh, if you can't get this pious woman Sarah to go to dinner with you in Havana, then you have to give me $1,000, which again is in 1950 money.
Significant, yeah. And,
yeah, and so it's supposed to be this absurd thing, but then he actually pulls it off because this is a musical, so of course he does.
It would be a very short musical if not. It would end at act one.
That's the junior version. It's a one act. He doesn't get her to go to Cuba, and then the show ends.
And the crap game goes off without a hitch at Joey Biltmore's garage.
And then they still sing Sit Down, You're Rocking the Boat for no reason at all, and then the show ends.
Yep, that's it. That's the final number in the reimagined one-act Guys and Dolls.
Hire me to adapt your one-acts, everybody. But I think you're right on that note you made a minute ago about, like, that's what makes this more accessible for sort of local and high school productions and everything, is, like, you do kind of only need one set and then a couple of, like, Cuban-themed props, and you're pretty much good to go.
And as you say, it is not a spider's web of intrigue, this musical. It is basically Nathan Detroit needs to host a crap game somewhere. He has to bet Sky Masterson. Sky Masterson has to take the nice mission doll to Cuba. He does. Oh, things happen in Cuba. They fall in love. Oh, they fall out of love. Well, now they have to get back together. How are they going to do that? Well, we're going to get all the gamblers to owe Sky a favor. And that's your musical.
Bang, bang, bang. We did it.
Yep.
I do like how the entire sort of last part of this musical relies on Sky winning a last second bet to roll dice correctly, which again, of course he does, because this is a musical and it would be shorter without that. I mean, shoot the moon, I guess. Just really go for it when you're in love.
And if you're gonna hinge it on something as ridiculous as I'm gonna roll some dice now and the dice will come up and determine whether I win or lose, have a nice song beforehand. Have a nice song and elaborate dance number. I think it is. I've always enjoyed the dramatic conceit of they cut away before people react to the how the dice turn out. Even if it's on Broadway, they do the coming out ha right and the drop the lights and no one knows for a little bit until, of course, the next scene begins and it's all the gamblers walking out of the sewer complaining about how they now have to go to a prayer meeting.
I don't think it's that hard of a bet to lose, but I guess it's a rough day for them particularly.
Well, yeah. I think as Big Julie says, if it word gets back that I went to a prayer meeting, no decent person will talk to me. It's all about reputation with these guys.
Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck, if you've ever been a lady to begin with, luck be a lady tonight.
This is also an amazing song, and it's one that has been covered extensively, which is really fun because, like, technically the lyrics are talking about the situation, but barely. It really is pretty vague about what luck is supposed to be doing besides something related to dice. And, you know, if you just have everybody just knows the chorus of Luck Be a Lady's Night, and, like, you can apply that to any situation you want.
Yes, it does. It's one of the few songs from this musical Sinatra actually worked into his act. Even though my understanding is he wasn't thrilled with the movie, just as people weren't thrilled with his interpretation of the movie, but he was very happy to work that into various live performances post movie.
Yeah, if you search it comes up as all Frank Sinatra first, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, and it's a swinging tune, and even though it has again been 3 decades since I was cast in it, when that comes on, I still sing the backup parts with the Roll 'em Snake Eyes and the harmonies and And so it's that wouldn't happen if it didn't stick to your brain. It's a really good song in that way.
I also have some very particular thoughts about the ending of this show.
It's a curious one.
It's very typical of the time, but it is, I don't know, I don't hate it. So basically, in the end, Sky has successfully gotten the sinners to the prayer meeting, which means that Sarah's not in trouble and they're kind of good. She realizes that he lied to protect her reputation, so she likes him again. Adelaide and Nathan have been going back and forth this whole time about whether or not they're actually getting married. But then Sarah and Adelaide basically have a meeting of the minds, and they're like, hey, our boyfriends suck a little bit, but we're going to marry them anyway and commit to fixing them over time.
Right. The song, the Marry the Man Today is the song, and the lyric is Marry the Man Today and Change His Ways Tomorrow.
It feels very much like when people are like, you know, you can't edit a blank page. You just have to get your first draft out there. Like, that is the attitude they are taking towards marriage.
A little bit. It's playful, and Frank Lesser does playful with his songs. There's a lot of nice interplay between Adelaide and Sarah on that song. It's clever, although it's really strange because it got cut out of the movie, or whether it was ever included in the movie. They just go straight from the prayer meeting to the finale. And in our high school production, we cut it out too.
Oh.
We just had the scene where they meet in the street and talk and go, yeah, we're going to change the man. And rather than sing the song, that was it. Drop curtain, go to finale. That was strange to me. And I always thought, unless you've got an Adelaide and a Sarah who can really do the interplay off of each other, that song can really be tedious. Whereas you really do need two actresses who interact well and can do the lyrics justice.
Yeah, absolutely. My favorite little bit in the song is when they're saying like what you can do to get your man into domestic life if he thinks about trying to stray. And Sarah says, have a baby. Adelaide says, 2, 6, 9, and then Sarah yells, stop.
And if he ever tries to stray from you, have a pot roast, have a headache, have a baby, have 2, 6, 9, stop, marry the man today.
But the thing that I like about this song, besides the fact that it's just like a fun song and it has really good interplay between the two actresses, is I feel like it's this very particular brand of like 1950s agency among female characters, in that, yes, in this show, as with most of the shows around this time, the female characters, like, their lives absolutely revolve around the men that they're trying to marry, and Sarah does kind of have a other thing going on, but like mostly not. Like, it's very much about the men, and yes, their stories revolve around them, et cetera, et cetera. It's 1950. But at the same time, they do have agency. They are intelligent. They are able to make decisions. They are able to assess the situation. They are able to pursue the goals that they have. Those goals happen to be all about the men, but like they, within the context of the story, they still are doing interesting things. And that's why I really don't like that the movie took this song out, because I feel like it removes this agency from the female characters and like this ability to see more insight into how much they've actually thought about it and how fun this moment is. And I get why the people take it out, because it does like slow down the momentum towards the finale, but I also think mm-hmm. it's important for their characters.
Oh, I very much agree that it's especially crucial for Sarah, who is a bit of a blank slate up until that song, and you finally get to see, no, she's not just this pristine mission doll. She actually has an interior life. And it's also, frankly, one of the songs that allows this musical to age well and not seem too much of a relic of its time, as opposed to say, Kiss Me, Kate, which has quite an opposite song at the end that modern revivals have to add like a wink and a nod when the actress who's playing Catherine sings about, oh, do what your husband says, wink.
Yeah,
but not really, wink. Yeah, so that is something I do appreciate about Guys and Dolls, and don't trust any version of it that cuts out that musical. Sorry, San Ramon Valley High class of 19 whatever.
I'm sure you guys did what you could, but
we did what we could with the material we were given. Someone was cast in a terrible role as a cop. So what can you do?
An undercover cop at that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this show was revived many, many times. Any musicals from this era, they didn't have that many. So the ones that were actually good, they just like kept putting them on. But this one was particularly possible because it was so beloved and popular and well-received.
And it's also interesting to see the various touches people put on it. Like the 1995 revival, they all dressed like that the Dick Tracy movie from 1990 with the bright primary colors on every suit. And the one revival I want to see, apparently it didn't do very well, but I'm still fascinated by it. It was about 11 years ago, and it was like Craig Bierko in the Skye Masterson part, Oliver Platt as Nathan Detroit, Lauren Graham as Miss Adelaide. That floored me. Oh, she's Sarah. No, she's Miss Adelaide. Oh, okay. Well, yeah, so I if anyone has any recording of that, I'd sure like to see it.
That is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that they only had 113 performances. Ooh. They did not like that.
Yeah, it was not well received. The New York Times review of that was not a positive one, but still I'm intrigued.
Yeah. There were a couple much more notable ones. As you keep referencing, the 90s Broadway revival was hugely successful.
One, yeah.
And it basically launched Nathan Lane's career. He had done some stuff, but this was his first like really standout role. And of course, he's done everything under the sun since then, including this more than once.
And it's the reunion of the Lion King guys, because Ernie Sabella is in there as Harry the Horse. J.K. Simmons is Benny Southstreet in that version. We were watching. My wife did get this one. We were watching the number from the Tonys, and my wife says, "Is that J.K. Simmons?" Yes, it is. Wow,
huh.
I didn't even notice. But yeah, J.K. Simmons is in a musical.
There was a 2005 West End version that had Ewan McGregor as Skye and Jane Krasinski as Adelaide.
Yes, okay. There was. I don't buy Ewan McGregor as Skye, but perhaps he has depths and layers I have yet to see. Jane Krakowski, I'm sure, would be fantastic.
Yeah, she would be a good Adelaide. That, mm-hmm. Man, Ewan McGregor is an interesting career.
Yeah.
And there have been multiple all-Black productions, which is also very interesting, including one in the UK in 2017 that moved the whole show to specifically 1939 Harlem, which sounds awesome.
I wonder how much adaptation you would have to do to the score, just because, you know, Harlem in the 1930s, you're evoking the Harlem Renaissance and jazz. But if anyone has any recordings of that, send them Phil's way, because I would love to hear it.
If anyone just has a database of Guys and Dolls bootlegs, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is a note that says it incorporated jazz, which I'd be very fascinated to hear. Like,
I would imagine.
How and where that showed up would be really cool to hear, I think. I mean, that was pretty recent, too. So, you know, there's always a chance maybe that production will come back in the later times somewhere in the US. We'll see
at some point.
But yeah, there is also a little bit of noise about making a remake of the movie. Apparently in 2019, TriStar Pictures got the remake rights. I don't think this needs to be remade.
I don't know. I'd like to see them make a good version of the movie, just because we're talking about these various stage versions. And the problem The problem with stage versions is that they're so ethereal, and you can't pull them up unless someone from PBS or someone recorded the soundtrack album. But with a movie, you have a point of reference that you can look at, and now anyone who listens to us here chatting so amicably about Guys and Dolls is going to get that 1955 movie and go, oh, the lead guy can't sing a lick, and the other guy seems so angry that he's in the comic role. So I would like them to do it, if for no other reason than, yeah, give me a version of Guys and Dolls that I can put on and not be irritated by at certain points in the production.
I guess that's fair. When the sort of definitive movie version is not up to snuff, I don't know. I just always am hesitant about specifically movie remakes of musicals from this era, because I think that there's a lot more... I think there's a lot more room, like, even within the original text and music, to bring things to a more modern spirit on the stage, and, like, how you stage them and cast them and direct them, versus, like, in a movie version, because everything has to be so much more firmly set. I think you do have to do a lot more work and make a lot more decisions about, like, how are you going to adjust the source material to fit your modern audience? And I think that often gets kind of weird when you get to source material that's this old.
I would agree with that. I would say that one of the nice things about Guys and Dolls is that it is kind of about this particular place and time, so that the look and feel of it, at least, you can keep doing over and over again in movies, and it still seems appropriate. You would obviously want to broaden the casting. You would maybe want to tweak a song here or there just to change the score a little bit, as that one production did. But one of the things that the 1955 movie did get right, and this was more a byproduct of how movies were made at the time, was instead of taking the cameras out and filming it for real in Times Square, they created this fakey-fake staged version of it. And your brain watching that musical goes, ah, yes, it's people singing in this not really real version of Times Square. I accept this. Whereas if they were to do it now, my fear is they'd actually go to Times Square and film gangsters in garish clothes singing about horses and who they're going to bet on. And your brain would be, what are you doing? People don't act like that for real. It's the dilemma of the musical. You have to make it unreal enough so that your audience goes, I am willing to accept for the next 2.5 hours that people will break into song.
Well, I'm hoping that maybe after Cats, musical theater directors have learned their lesson about trying too hard to approach realism, but we'll see.
So get Tom Hooper to direct Guys and Dolls Revival, oh my God, is what we're saying.
Stop letting that man direct things.
Zoom right up Miss Adelaide's nose as she's singing about her cold, and there you go. It's great. Oscar, baby.
You don't have to have an answer for this, but do you have any thoughts on who you would cast on a new version of the movie?
God, I wouldn't even know where to start. You know, Chris Pine seems like he'd be a good choice for Skye Masterson off the top of my head. Nathan Detroit is a toughie, as we were talking about earlier. Who'd you get? Because you don't necessarily need someone to sing. You just need someone who has a certain vibe and attitude about them. So, I'm not sure. I'm going to have to think about that. And, like, later on tonight, I'll bolt out of bed and go, of course, Don Cheadle! And then that'll be that.
Well, if we have a definitive cast by the time this episode comes out, I'll put it in the show notes. And if anyone has their own suggestions, you can tweet them at us.
No, I'm going to be thinking about this for the next week and arguing about it with my wife, and we'll have a cast list for you.
Well, I'm so glad I've given you a project.
Yeah, no, I need something to live for.
Well, I think that brings us to the lightning round.
Oh, no!
I've never gotten that reaction before.
Oh, I'm worried that I won't be able to I don't answer things quickly. As you may have noticed, I tend to ramble, so I'll do my best to keep it short.
Oh, this round has never once been lightning.
Okay.
But we'll start with, what is your favorite song?
Okay. I would say that my favorite song within the context of the musical is Luck Be a Lady, because that's the showpiece. But if we're talking about songs that you would hear out in the wild, independent of the musical, I've Never Been in Love Before, because that is a song you can do a lot with. You can make it light and breezy. You can make it soulful. I've got a couple of different jazz recordings of that song by Oscar Peterson and Cal Jader, and it's good. It's a good song.
I appreciate the distinction between different contexts. It's very thoughtful.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What is your favorite line in the musical?
Oh, favorite line. That is a good one. I am going to have to go with, I think it's polka dots. What a crazy color, whatever. But when they're betting, when Sky bets on Nathan's tie color for the same $1,000 on the sucker bet that Nathan was trying to get him. And I think in the stage version, it is occasionally blue. What a stupid color. And that's a good line. And I also, just to repeat the line earlier, if people back home know I went to a prayer meeting, no decent person will talk to me. That's a good line.
That's just perfectly encapsulates the mood.
Mm-hmm.
Who was your favorite character?
Oh, let's say Big Julie. He's just so fun, and in the hands of a good comic actor, he really brings a lot to the show. One of the speaking of great lines, there's a line in the mission scene where Nathan gives the heartfelt apology to Sarah about how they're all very sorry that they gambled in the mission, and he gets all the gamblers to mumble their assent. Yes, we're sorry. And Big Julie stands up and goes, I'm really sorry. And I just think that's tremendous, especially when B.S. Pulley does it in the movie. That's great. But there's a lot of material that you can do with that part.
Well, if you were going to be in the show again, who would you want to play?
I can tell you who I would not want to play, and that is Lieutenant Brannigan. But the egoist in me says Benny Southstreet. When I'm listening to the soundtrack, I will sing Benny's parts. Mm. But in reality, I know that the best I can ever aspire to be is Harry the Horse.
Who would you recommend go see this show?
Oh, golly. You know, it's a nice family show. I mean, I hate to say that. That sounds so terrible, but it really is one of those shows that you can take your kids, take your parents, take your aunts and uncles to, and everyone's going to get something out of it. But in a broader sense, I would say that anyone who wants to see what musicals were like in the 1950s, this was a good one to sample.
Sure is. And finally, if you could combine this musical with another one, which one would you pick?
Oh boy. Well, this is tough, because you know, I was trying to do mashups in like Guys and Dolls and The King and I, and that would be terrible, where gangsters are showing up at the palace in Siam. But I think, as we touched on earlier, it's such a distinctly written play with its own line of dialogue. You really can't mash it up with something else. What you would have to do is find a double feature, as it were. And I think keeping with those, if you buy my argument that Guys and Dolls is the quintessential American musical in that it is about a certain time and place and mindset and spirit that was present in a part of America, another part of America that a certain musical captures, I think, is Music Man. And I think that's a nice one-two punch. You've got the big city folk and the small town folk. And which life would you want to lead? Well, not the small town one, I would say. But at least there's a nice music teacher there.
Wow. I can see, you know, Harold Hill getting in a fight with Nathan Detroit.
I think Harold Hill would fit very well in the Guys and Dolls musical, and perhaps someone wants to do some fanfic where he's a traveling salesman because he's been run out of New York by Harry the Horse and Benny South Street. And that's why he has to travel the rails in the Midwest, duping Iowans into giving him their milk money for a band that will never play.
Oh, there is absolute potential for a crossover here.
Yeah, and then one day Big Julie shows up in town and mucks everything up.
The Music Man cinematic universe.
Yeah, exactly. And then at the end, Uncle Arvide shows up and says, "I need you to come join the Save a Soul mission, Harold." And that's the stinger.
Phil, thank you so much for talking to me about Guys and Dolls. This has been so much fun.
I'm always happy to talk about musicals and not have people turn away in disgust, so thank you.
That's what this show is for. And thank you, everybody out there, for listening. Goodbye! Thank you for listening to this episode of Corner of the Sky. You can find Phil on Twitter at Philip Michaels. You can find our show notes at theincomparable.com/COTS, and you can follow us on Twitter at COTS Podcast. I'll see you next month!